Welcome to New Books in Film. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Lee J. Cobb is likely one of the best examples of what is called a character actor, even though the term is often considered to be a slight. Yet Cobb had success on so many different levels, from stage to film to television, that his best-known parts are still worth seeking out. In his book, Lee J. Cobb, Characters of an Actor, Donald Dewey shows Cobb's importance in both acting and current events from during his career. The book was published in 2014 by Roman and Littlefield. Don talks to me about Cobb's background, how it affected his career and his life, and how that life was changed during the 1950s blacklist period. We also talk about some of Cobb's greatest roles. Welcome to Donald Dewey. Hi, Don. Thanks for talking to me.
No problem, Joe.
I'm sure a lot of younger filmgoers probably would not know the name Lee J. Cobb. I'm a little older, so I have heard of him, but it wasn't until I read the book that I remembered a lot of the specific roles from films that I'd seen. But I also found it interesting that you used parts of his career to illustrate some other social and artistic concepts. But let's start with your background. You've got extensive writing experience, but what's your educational experience and writing that led you to decide that you wanted to write more, as much as you have, about film?
That's a good question. Actually, I have now published about 40 books of fiction, nonfiction, and drama, and the film books are actually just one niche of that. I've done several novels, also a history of political cartoons, and also a whole other sheaf of books, believe it or not, dealing with the history of baseball.
Actually, I was going to ask about that next. So yes, no, I saw that, and it actually made me even more interested in your writing.
I hope so.
No, I'm a big baseball fan, so that was interesting when I saw that.
Yeah, that was actually, it was a friend and I. Well, how do you get interested in writing? That's always a crazy question. I mean, yes, when I was 13 or 14 years old, I used to write, these kind of James Bond kind of things, which I'd write a chapter and I'd give them to my brother. My brother would say, no, I don't like this, change that. And the two of us, that's how we used to spend time after school sometimes. And then when I was in school, I went to both high school and college to a Jesuit school, and one of my early teachers was Daniel Berrigan. And he's mostly known, I think, to most people now as the major war resister during the Vietnam time. But he was also a poet, and he encouraged me a lot, and in fact, to the point where he'd say, I don't want you writing the assignment tonight. I want you instead reading these three books and go home and then give me a special book report next week on them. So along the way, I did get a lot of encouragement from people. Then after I got, after a few years, I started writing for newspapers because at a certain point, writers find themselves at a fork in the road. They can go and they can study and become teachers and even teaching fiction, or they can stay on the streets. And I never was comfortable with the classroom. And so I always was a reporter for newspapers or just a freelance magazine contributor, things like that. And then I spent 14 years in Europe. And that also, I think, beyond the actual writing, it gave me more things to write about. So in terms of where the writing comes from, as ultimately anybody would have to answer this question, it comes from life experiences.
And I was going to ask you about the sports books, but before I mention that, have you written anything about Berrigan? Have you ever considered writing anything about Berrigan?
No, I think he's written enough about himself. I just don't find that an urgent thing because the two of us worked together a great deal during Parallel, because I was in Europe, he was here. But we both did a lot of political work during the Vietnam War. And so, you know, and I also did a lot of writing during that period, too, for the, what were at that time were called the underground journals.
And that is an it's a period that's, we are obviously seeing a lot of writing about now, and or we have, and it's given the recent periods to the post-Vietnam era, you know, just ending 50 years ago, or 40 years ago.
Unfortunately, a lot of it is not. I mean, a lot of politicians have an interest in calling it the post-Vietnam era, and unfortunately, some of the lessons not learned then are still happening now, and nobody seems to be aware of it, and they just want to. Oh, well, we'll dismiss that, you know, like it didn't really count. You know, yes, it did count. And the idea of people being branded with being associated with that period is really itself a political calculation in what we might, you know, we can now call the, you know, Mitch McConnell era. And so don't get me started on that, okay?
That's okay. No, I understand your points about that, and I also agree with you about the concepts of forgetting the – we don't learn from the past like we should. And that's, of course, always one of the big issues with history is do people pay enough attention to it? And I think you would probably agree that the answer to that is no, or even if they do, they still use it for their own purposes.
There you go. Yeah, I think you're, I think what you said, the latter part of that is far more relevant, you know.
So, but what about the sports books, baseball in particular? Obviously, you have to be a baseball fan to write about it.
Yeah, I grew up, and this I'm sure also will kind of be obscure to some of your listeners, but I grew up actually only four blocks away from Ebbets Field, the old Brooklyn Dodger stadium. And in those days, it wasn't like today where, you know, like every game was a night game. In those days, the Dodgers used to play games, their afternoon game started at 2:30 in the afternoon. And I went to school, you know, within two or three blocks from there. And so we always got out of school in time to go over to the stadium. And it was like you could get seats for 25 cents or 50 cents. You could sit out in the bleachers, or you could even get standing room, really, behind home plate. And now they have the 81-81 schedule. In those days, it was 77-77, 77 home games, 77 away games. And there were a couple of years there where, thanks to that kind of convenience of timing, my brother and I actually were there, physically there, for more than 60 games out of the 77. So, I mean, like, so we were, you know, we grew up as fanatics as anybody else in Brooklyn did. And, in fact, I knew... Personally, I knew Jackie Robinson. I knew Gil Hodges. I knew Carl Ferrillo. And these were kind of neighborhood people. And that's, you know, another concept that's kind of foreign today with, you know, most of the players kind of living in their Waldorf mansions in suburbia. But these people lived in the heart of Brooklyn. And so, you know, there was nothing, I would say nothing, A, strange about being interested in baseball, or B, being particularly overwhelmed by it. I mean, it was just something that was part of the natural atmosphere of, you know, getting up in the morning. I mean, you went to school, you did this, you did that, then you listened to the Dodgers. I mean, I can remember my grandmother, who was an immigrant from Ireland, and... In those days, she, you know, this was even before television, she used to stay up. In those days, the furthest west that the teams would go would be St. Louis. And in those days, of course, the games would get broadcast back to New York. It was after 11 o'clock. Sometimes it would go to midnight. And she was blind at that point, but she would stay in front of the radio. She would never go to bed until the St. Louis games were over, and she'd be sitting there in front of the radio cursing this Dodger that didn't get a hit, blasting that St. Louis Cardinal who did get a hit, and it went on and on. I mean, this was a kind of culture. This is part of the culture. And so vice versa, you can also understand what the shock was when the Dodgers left.
Yeah, I think we could go on and on talking about baseball as a cultural experience, especially during that period. My mother's 91, and there's no question her favorite sport is still baseball, and I'm sure it has a lot to do with she grew up with it when it really was the sport that people lived with.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it was, and you know, the idea of, then television came along, and football is a creation of television, and the idea that it's become the national pastime is always, to me, a very, very dubious proposition. What it is television is the national pastime, and football happens to be part of it, which is not quite the same thing, I don't think, as when baseball was known as the national pastime.
Right. Well, let's move on to Lee J. Cobb, since that's specifically the reason why we talked. But I really liked a lot of the background, too, having spent some time learning more about what you had written. Why did you decide in 2014, or to publish, you know, I know it came out in 2014, but why write a book about Lee J. Cobb at this time?
There were some very strange things. I lived in Europe, as I said before, for 14 years, and I had never really thought about writing movie books at all. And one day I was sitting in a restaurant with this friend of mine, and she was a film critic, and she just said, "Did you ever think of writing a book about film?" And I said, I could not believe, Joel, that I had even, that these thoughts had ever been circulating. I said, if I ever were to write a book about film, there would be four subjects I would go after right away. And she said, what? And frankly, I was astonished that these things came out of my mouth so fast. I said, the first one would be Marcello Mastroianni. The second one would be Jimmy Stewart. The third one would be John Huston. The fourth one would be Lee J. Cobb. And as it turned out, I actually ended up writing three of those four. I did the Mastroianni book, I did the Stewart book, and I've done the Cobb book. The only one I have not done is John Huston, and the reason why I haven't done it is because somebody's already done it, and there's nothing I could add to what this book has already done. But so that was kind of like the first time that the thought ever occurred to me that I could do these kind of things. And years passed before I ever, you know, I would write articles sometimes about film. The first one I did was the Mastroianni book. The second one was the Stewart book. And then finally, a couple of years back, I thought, you know, I've done the other two. Why don't I do the Cobb book? Now, Cobb had a particular attraction to me, both personal and let's just say theoretical. To get to the personal first. To begin with, believe it or not, I have an uncle, or had an uncle, who could have been his twin brother. And I mean, physically. I mean, the guy just looked so much like Lee J. Cobb that my aunts used to say, you know, whenever they'd get annoyed with him, they'd say things like, "Sit down, Lee J., sit down," you know, and that kind of thing. And that became kind of like a family thing. It was very funny. Then, when I was at college, I used to do a weekly radio show, and one of the features of the weekly radio show was an interview. And one of the people that I decided I was going to interview was Lee J. Cobb, and I went to the Plaza Hotel, and we had an extraordinarily good hour or so of talking, and in the course of talking, I mentioned the fact that I had written a play, and he had not been on Broadway really since Death of a Salesman, and he said, and that was years before, and he said to me, he said, "Let me see it. Send it to me." Well, I cannot tell you that within something like, and mind you, I'm 18 years old at this point, 18 or 19 years old, and something within 2 or 3 weeks, suddenly my agent is getting excited because she's heard from Cobb's agent. He really likes to play. And on that basis, they were already drafting directors and things. And in the casting, I mean, like, his Cobb went back to California to do a movie. But all of this suddenly, you know, like, it's out of control. I mean, just this passing conversation we had, and, well, as you can tell, it didn't happen, and the reason it didn't happen was because he had a heart attack, and he could not take on the physical requirements of a play, and in fact, that's why he ended up doing the television series, The Virginian, because he was able to make a lot of money and kind of work minimally. Because in those kind of Westerns, television Westerns, you really had to show up once or twice a week. Or, like, I guess the more popular one was Gunsmoke. James Arness used to work like 4 days a month. He would get all his shots done in those 4 days. And sometimes that would involve, you know, different episodes. He would be, you know, acting with one guy in episode one, then he'd be acting with somebody else in episode nine. But because these people had the kind of swagger they did, they were able to enforce in their contracts, no, I want all of this done within such and such a time. And that's the way they kept. And the same thing was true of Cobb in The Virginian. And so you had kind of like three or four other regulars. Anyway, so all of this was the initial part. Then when I was in Rome, I ran into him again because he was over there like all the American actors in the 70s were over in Rome shooting films over there because they were, again, they were getting very, very well paid for relatively little work. I mean, they would do about five or six scenes. Everybody remembers, you know, probably the most famous ones. Clint Eastwood, obviously, was the most famous. Charles Bronson and Lee Van Cleef also kind of like shored up their reputations by going over there. But they were not the only ones. I mean, we're talking about scores and scores of people, whether it was Rod Steiger or Robert Mitchum or Arthur Kennedy, all of these actors of the 60s and 70s, they worked over there quite frequently because it was, as I say, it was good money. And in many cases, it was great parts, too, the kind of parts they could not get back here. So I met him over there, and again, we talked, and we remembered the incident of the heart attack and the play and all of that. So all of that kind of, you know, like, all of this is explaining the personal connection to it. The professional connection or the theoretical connection to it was the fact that this man was really involved in every major incident involving actors in the 20th century. Started off, I mean, people don't remember it, but in the 1920s, there was what you would call proletariat street theater. He was involved in all of that. Then he joined the group theater, which actually was not the, you know, raving left-wing thing that a lot of people would like to remember it as. If anything, it was a far more polished aesthetic group than certainly the left-wing proletarian theater was. But it did, and it ended up in the sights of the House Un-American Activities Committee later on, because, it didn't think, you know, that anybody who joined the Communist Party was automatically a traitor. And the far more interesting part of it was that I would say like 75% of the members of the group theater were Jews. And there was nothing so rampant among the House Un-American Activities Committee as anti-Semitism. I mean, like, almost if you go through the history of that, you see how much they had Jews, American Jews, in their sights. And this, of course, was not strange at all for New York, for New York theater, which at that time was the capital of the theater world. I mean, the idea of the regional theaters that you have today, that did not exist to such a prominent degree as it does now. But the fact is that New York was the capital of the theater world. And one quarter of the population of New York at the time was Jewish. So there was hardly any kind of coincidence in the fact that there were so many Jews in the American theater. So this was, you know, this was a way of these characters in Hoop. Anyway, Cobb was part of that. He was part of the film when the first Blacklist hit. He was part of just about every kind of movement that involved film, whether it was long-term contracts, breaking contracts, the entire history of Hollywood it was, in one way or another, was kind of like conveyed through his own personal struggles. So all of these were reasons. And then of course, there was the biggest, to me, if there has ever been a classic written for the American stage, it was Death of a Salesman. And Cobb was Willie Loman, the original Willie Loman. And, you know, to this day, there was a time, Joe, where there would be people in New York, actors of a generation now, I guess you would say, of the age of the Pacinos and the Hoffmans, the 60, 70-year-olds. Lee J. Cobb was considered the greatest actor in America, mainly because of Death of a Salesman. And so, you know, all of these were reasons to me to be interested in the subject.
Well, in fact, it was the part, I mean, some of the political and some of the social background you gave it early on in the book, and it goes through the rest of the book too, but that was the part that I found particularly interesting, because some of that background I didn't remember or I didn't know as well, and it is interesting how he was involved in all of that just because he was there. I mean, to a large extent, it was just a normal aspect during the 30s in particular. And it's not a big surprise. People don't remember that period of time, that given the economic situation, it's not a big surprise that political unrest would be something where people would be drawn to something different because of how bad things were in general.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and don't forget, this the other thing, of course, like this probably is on a little more theoretical level, the other thing which distinguished the group theater was Stanislavski and what became known as the Method.
Right, I was going to be asking you about that, so that's good.
This was a direct descendant of what Stanislavski had done with the Moscow Art Theater in Moscow. And these were the first people, and of course they themselves then became the parents of the Actors Studio and the various Brandos and you know, all those people. So that this, too, was considered, you know, like something striking. And in fact, a lot of the criticisms, a lot of the critiques of the plays that the group theater put on, a lot of them were just, you know, even though sometimes they didn't like the plays, they were just absolutely startled by this new approach to acting. And it was different. I mean, it's hard to remember now, but once upon a time, I mean, these plays in New York were recited. I mean, recited. It was hand to the breast and shout up to the balcony. And if it wasn't like that, it was this kind of like English mannerism kind of thing that you can still see on the old movies on Turner Classic Movies. And the Method and the Actors Studio kind of Stanislavski training, that completely overthrew all of those concepts and brought in a new kind of actor. I mean, they were not interested. The only people, I always found this interesting, that the group theater lasted for a decade, but the only so-called leading men that came out of it were Franchot Tone and John Garfield. All the rest of them were what you would consider, you know, like what is casually called the character actor, the Cobbs and the Luther Adlers and people like that. And even, you know, even John Garfield used to absolutely, you know, get hot when somebody would call him a star rather than an actor. So that they were interested in the parts. They were not interested in the glamour, the so-called stardom. The only one who really ever did come out of it as a star, as they say, probably was Franchot Tone. And Tone himself was, he always was very, very, let's say, uncomfortable with the idea that the others kind of looked at him and say, well, now you've got all that money out in Hollywood. Why don't you give some of it to us? And he did. I mean, he really did. He was kind of guilted into it. And he sponsored a lot of, he financed a couple of their productions before they collapsed altogether, just simply because he considered himself to himself something of a traitor that he had not stayed to do these, you know, Clifford Odets kind of plays.
You talk in the early part about how the theater company was run, the concept that everybody had a voice, and that concept that while everybody had, you know, there were people who ran it, and there were directors and writers, of course, but even every actor had a voice as to what was going to be performed, how things were being run, and those are the kind of things that probably nowadays, no, it would be completely unbelievable to most people that you could actually run a theater.
Believe it or not, there are some small theaters that do still operate like that. When you had something the size of the group theater, you had, of course, the other part of the democracy was the chaos, and you had constantly chaos because, you know, this group wants this, that group wants this, and so you did need at a certain point, and that's why you had a couple of breakups. I mean, at one point, you know, they all went to Hollywood. They all decided they're going to, you know, get out of here. And they broke up two or three different times. And little by little, the strongest voice in it became probably Ilya Kazan. Strasberg was there, but he was not... a lot of the actors hated Strasberg. And this was an experience which was kind of repeated when the Actors Studio got created in the late 40s and the 50s. But the difference is, and I guess if you talk to anybody today and they talk about Stanislavski's method, there are two groups which come immediately to mind, and one is the group theater of the 30s, and the other is the Actors Studio of the post-war time. But there was an enormous difference between the two of them in the sense that also for social reasons, as you said before, the 30s were a time of incredible social and economic ferment, and so, you know, you had a far more kind of dedicated resolve to doing plays which, you know, as they say, you know, like, had a message. In the late 40s and 50s, when they started the Actors Studio here, which had the same principles and were run by basically the same people. I mean, once again, you had Kazan, and you had Strasberg, and, you know, and you had a couple of other people who were in, Cheryl Crawford, who were involved in the group theater. But there were two major differences. Number one, it just so happened that when the Actors Studio started, that was also the time that television started. And you had all of these live dramas being shot in New York. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights, it was Studio One, it was Playhouse 90, it was the Philco Playhouse. And so there was a lot of work for the actors trying out this new medium. The second part of it was, because there was this new work from television, these actors were not obscure very long. Because when, you know, the Studio One on Monday night was shown at 10 o'clock, they were seeing that in Los Angeles, too. And so these actors, and now we're talking about the Paul Newmans and the Joanne Woodwards and the Steigers, and all of these people suddenly became nationally known practically before they, you know, like, had finished the first year at the Actors Studio. And what was the other part of it was that they were all leading men. And they were leading men and leading actresses, whether they were Lee Remick or Joanne Woodward, Anthony Franciosa. These were not like the group theater actors who were, as you know, using that phrase again, the character actors. These were leading men, and Hollywood was craving new actors. Mainly because of things like the House Un-American Activities Committee. They wanted to divorce themselves from a lot of these old faces. They wanted new faces. They wanted to show people that, you know, that they were still thriving and ready to go. And so the experience was totally, totally different. That even though they had the same training, that their own success, their own social success, was totally different because of the general surrounding social situation.
You talk about these television and how it suddenly gave work to people, more work, and you look through Cobb's television experience as an actor, and if you go through the 50s, you're right, he's on one anthology show after another in all kinds of different roles, literally from 51 right on through. It's just one after another you see him listed as a character, and it clearly showed that there was a way now to continue to act using with television.
Well, that was true of just about anybody who, you know, and the bigger the name, and especially him, because this was after Death of a Salesman, and he did have a reputation. The one blanket on that, of course, was the House and American Activities Committee, and these blacklists did circulate, and it made it very difficult for anybody who had, let's just say, a sentient human being who was over 40 years old, it made it very difficult for them to avoid all of these greengrocers and their blacklist lists. That's why you had a lot more 20-year-olds. That's why you had a lot more of people like Newman and even Brando. People like this who were not involved in the 30s and you couldn't point a finger at them and say, you did this or you did that. They didn't even have to, you know, deny anything because they just simply hadn't been around then. And so that's why Hollywood found a lot of these people safer to deal with. It's a fascinating period, and unfortunately it has been just so, you kind of think it's over and then you come back. I mean, we talk today about, and we feel so superior to it. Oh, well, how could these people, you know, how could these crazy senators, you know, do this, or this congressman do this? But then, you know, how long ago was it? A year ago that this clown Peter King was chairing this subcommittee, saying, no, we only want to bring in and talk about Muslim terrorism. And his own party, people in his own party said, wait a minute, there were things like Oklahoma City too. I mean, shouldn't we be talking to them? No. We just want to talk to the Muslims. I mean, it's not that we have gotten away from any of this.
It's just different ways of doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's different names, different, you know, whatever. And this, of course, as I, you know, did in the book, and it was very hard talking even to his children about this, because at a certain point he'd name names. And he broke down, he named names, and by that time they had driven his wife into a sanitarium. They had, she would go to the supermarket, and they'd be there checking out what she bought. And so after a while, and then of course this is without even getting into, you know, like suddenly the jobs dried up. And there were very, very few people from that period who had the guts to fight. I mean, one of the other person, and probably nobody, suffered more than Cobb, or probably the only one who did was Sterling Hayden. Sterling Hayden hated himself for the rest of his life because he had given names. And he used to call, and even the books he wrote about himself, and he would call himself a weasel. And the self, he would beat himself up constantly, and he would, like, you know, and you had to be a very, very strong character. For instance, I mean, one who was, and Hayden always said this, one who was just sticking to actors for a second, was Robert Ryan, and Robert Ryan just told him to go screw themselves. And Ryan was the one who put up Hayden when nobody else wanted to put him up. And it takes a particular kind of courage to do that. And, you know, and I think we always have to be wary of kind of saying, you know, like, well, he's a coward, he broke up. And a lot of these people were not forgiven, ever. I think, I don't know if you got to the point where even at the end, toward the end of his career, Cobb was acting in Rome. And one of the other actors in the picture, in this Italian picture with him, was James Whitmore. And at a certain point, the director, the agent, Whitmore's agent, said to him, "Well, how are you getting along with Lee?" And Whitmore said, "I don't talk to him. Why should I talk to somebody who betrayed, you know, people like him?" This was 25 years later. And so, you know, a lot of people just simply did not forget.
But as you point out, the problem is it's not like Cobb just immediately decided, well, I'm just going to roll over and name names. It certainly wasn't something that he did by happenstance. It was a terrible process for him to decide that he had to, or that he felt that he had to.
Absolutely, and there were and there were horrible, horrible examples. I think, in a sense, even far more pathetic than the people who. Let me just back up for a second. Nehemiah Persoff, who was a wonderful character actor, and worked with Cobb in a lot of movies. Persoff told me a story which was scary. He said he was doing a play with Cobb on television, and he was playing a guard, and at a certain point the he's supposed to put Cobb back in his cell, and at a certain point, he decides to improvise the line. He says, "Get back in there, you scum," or something like that. And he said, and it worked. You know, the director loved it. 20 years later, Joel, they are together working in another picture in Italy. And Cobb looks at him and says, "It was because of my testimony, wasn't it?" And Persoff says, "What? What are you talking about? What?" He said, "That's why you call me a scum, throwing me into that cell." And Persoff said, I had no idea what to say to him, because all I was doing was improvising a line in the context of the play we were doing. It had nothing to do with, but for 20 years he had carried around that thought that Persoff had done it as a criticism of his testimony.
I could only imagine that, yes, he was able to continue to work, but if that was the kind of thing that he was carrying around with him at all times, it couldn't have made work always particularly enjoyable.
No, it did not. It did not. And, you know, this was a, you know, the thing to remember about and the actor Robert Vaughn is wonderful on this. We talked about this a couple of times, and he said, "Let's not forget who were the so-called friendly witnesses during all of this." And it's true. If you look at the old films of who testified in front of the House American Activity Committee as friendly witnesses, you know, the guys who went there to denounce all this communism around them, they were all actors, with one exception, they were all actors whose best days were behind them. Robert Taylor hadn't done any of the Ivanhoe things in years. Ginger Rogers hadn't been Kitty Foyle in 12 years. Richard Arlen, nobody even remembered who the hell he was. These were all people whose careers were over. They were no longer considered A-list actors. The only one who was still considered an A-list actor, and this is an hilarious story, and it also tells you the level of preparation that these people did. The only one who went there as an A-list actor to say the committee was doing a great job was Gary Cooper. And the only reason Gary Cooper went, and this is hilarious, is because he received an accusation that he was the head of the Peruvian Communist Party. The reason he got that accusation was because the head of the Peruvian Communist Party in the mountains, in the Andes, was using Gary Cooper as his code name.
It's, of course, like you've pointed out, going back, it's unbelievable how little things like that, even today, can taint people because somebody either, as you say, you know, like in that situation, misunderstood something and decided, well, I'm going to run with this.
Exactly.
We're going to call him forward because somebody in the Peruvian mountains is using his name, mm-hmm. even though it didn't mean anything by itself.
Precisely. And the other thing, and this I think is really important to understand, is that the major movement, the major people behind all of these, the ones who welcomed the House Un-American Activities Committee to Hollywood, was this group that was headed by John Wayne and Ward Bond. But John Wayne never appeared in front of that committee to say that they were doing a great job. Why? Because there was no way in hell any of these studios were going to let the John Waynes or the Bing Crosbys or the Bob Hopes get in front of a microphone and suddenly tell this, you know, 75-year-old senator who could barely see that he was a great American hero. There was too much of a... John Wayne was supposed to be the hero, not them. And the fact is, it was a box office thing to make sure that none of these, you know, hero types ever went close to a courtroom. Never, never, never. Because that would have confused people. They would remember, as Vaughn told me one time, he said, don't forget that people might look at that film one day, but, you know, 2 years from down the road, they'll remember he was in front of that committee, but they'll forget why. And so nobody wanted to take that chance. And I'll say, and this is also worth, I think, pointing out, it wasn't just the left-wingers who were blacklisted. There were a couple of screwballs, and I mean out-and-out screwballs, like Adolphe Manjou. Adolphe Manjou was probably the hardest-working character actor in Hollywood for something like 25 years. He also had a lot of screws loose, and he believed that Stalin used to come over to the United States at night and bring gold bars so that he and Roosevelt would put these gold bars together in Fort Knox for safekeeping. These are not exaggerations. And this guy said these things in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, that Roosevelt and Stalin were plotting to corner all the gold in the world. Okay? So suddenly, this guy who had been working, you know, making four or five films a year, he couldn't work anymore either. Because he too was bad for box office. Because what good's a character actor when people are saying, "Oh no, that's the screwball who thinks Roosevelt and Stalin are, you know, hoarding all this money." They would not be good for the box office. And it took years. And so Manjou ended up blacklisted as much as some of the lefties. And it wasn't until Kirk Douglas got hired him in Paths of Glory that Manjou could work again.
Well, and Kirk Douglas was known for hiring other blacklisted people as well. So
yeah, exactly.
Well, that's what I was saying at the beginning. One of the things that I found so interesting about the book was you use Cobb as a great example or an illustration of what the political and social situation was like from the 30s, but through the 50s, when particularly all of these things were going on with it. There's been a lot of writing about the blacklist and about the House Un-American Activities Committee, but I think you gave it a much, by using Cobb, it was a nice way to give it a human face, there, how it was affecting individuals as opposed to the whole concept this was going on, how people were affected on their daily lives because of all of this, because of the witch hunt.
Yeah, well, I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
That was the purpose, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the acting parts, acting-related things, because you've talked a little bit about method acting, and one of the things I like about the early part of the book is that you go into details to what that meant. You obviously broke out the concept that this was not, you know, it has a... When people hear the phrase or when they heard it, they had their ideas. And you clearly showed that there was more to it than just that. It wasn't a gimmick. It wasn't something that, as you pointed out earlier about it, was it was an important part of changing how people acted And you go into a lot of detail about that, including the fact that it wasn't as Stanislavski didn't invent it. It was something that people had done, but he was one of its major proponents.
Exactly. And in fact, I you know, to skip for a second back to the book I did before Cobb in Hollywood, I mean, I was surprised, even though I'd kind of taken it in, absorbed it kind of unconsciously, how many people from the Actors Studio, for instance, and I'm talking about Pacino and Shelley Winters and Ben Gazzara, how many of them pointed to Jimmy Stewart as a classic example of a method actor, even though he never would admit it. I mean, like, you know, because he wasn't doing it consciously. He was doing what they were doing, but he was doing it kind of instinctively. And they would say, you know, look at the difference if you have some week to look at all the movies that they show on Turner Classic Movies. Look at the difference between what Stewart does and what Cooper or Wayne or all these others do, and the difference is actually alarming when you see it, because all of them had kind of like built this character, these stoic characters around yup, you know, and like the dialogue was spare, the emotions were kind of like two or three eyes left, right, and center. Stewart, on the other hand, was an emotional wreck. I mean, he was always emotional. He was always playing these characters who could go from the so-called benign characters of something like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington to become probably the nastiest character. And this I always found hilarious. The people always thought of him as, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or as Harvey. And in fact, nobody made more brutal westerns than he did. I mean, Jimmy Cagney had nothing on him. I mean, he was ready to do the hardest characters that you could ever imagine. Or even I mean, what is a gloomier picture? And I've always thought it was hilarious that they always show It's a Wonderful Life around Christmas. It's supposed to be a Christmas movie. No, it isn't. It is actually the bleakest, darkest movie you ever want to see. And Stewart goes relatively crazy in it, as he did in most movies. But the point I was trying to make is that just because somebody's called a method actor and somebody else is not called does not mean they're not, you know, drinking from the same trough. But probably the single most successful film ever made from I'd say a congregation of method performers was On the Waterfront. And there you had all of the different aspects of it coming together. You had, first of all, Kazan was the director. Then you had Cobb from the group theater. You had Brando. You had Steiger. You had Eva Marie Saint. And Carl Malden Malden was also from the group theater. You had Saint, Steiger, and Brando from the Actors Studio. And you could tell that there was such a level of intensity. Even the small roles in that picture by people like Leif Erikson. Leif Erikson had played the kind of like the investigator. He came from the group theater. Martin Balsam, who played his assistant, he came from the Actors Studio. They all kind of like coalesced around this, and you can see the improvisations, the kind of direction that Kazan always had. There's not a scene, for instance, I think it's one of the most striking things, there's not a single scene in the picture between Cobb and Brando that's not in some way, shape, or form violent. I mean, every single scene is Cobb slapping him around or slapping him on the cheek, pulling him on the cheek, slap, you know, punching him in the arm until you get to the final violent thing at the end. But that was a single direction, and they all knew it. They all had this kind of, they were all on the same beam. And if you watch that film, you can see, and Saint was just as good as the men in it, you can see a kind of personal commitment to the role that you just simply would find foreign in any film shot in the 30s. You know, I mean, it's striking. I can see that film 100 times, and I can still see things that I had not seen before.
One of his other major roles that is probably, if anybody's going to know a Lee J. Cobb role, it's going to be from 12 Angry Men.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, that to me, that is the second best thing he ever did. Again, there you had a completely serious atmosphere. You had 12 of, you know, well-known actors in New York City with Henry Fonda. And there was no stardom stuff about that movie. They all sat around, and that's why that was Sidney Lumet's first film. And Hal Lumet, you know, I mean, he must have felt like the lion tamer going into the, you know, into the cage, because I mean, like the smallest parts were still, you know, the Jack Klugmans and the Robert Webbers and the Begleys. Everybody knew who these people were. I mean, these were all solid actors, you know. And then, you know, and the fact that there was such a level of professionalism throughout that film just told you that, you know, that's why Lumet chose that as his first film, because he didn't want to have any, you know, divas around him. And none of these guys were divas. But if you want to see, I think, one of the classic examples of, to get back to Cobb and what the method technique can bring you, is watch Cobb right near the end, where he just gets into this final rage and starts tearing up his son's picture. And that's kind of like the parallel to the scene in On the Waterfront, where Brando has just testified against him and Cobb is passing him and he just wants to kill him. And the way the gradations of violence just build in him, that you cannot do without the kind of training you receive in Stanislavski. Those two scenes, the one in 12 Angry Men at the end when he's tearing up the picture, and the one in On the Waterfront. That, to me, are two of the best examples of what the method is all about.
Well, and the good thing is both 12 Angry Men and On the Waterfront are easy to see. I mean, they're easy to find either in video, but also, like you say, they show up quite often on Turner Classic Movie. So getting a chance to see them, this is one of the great things, is not right. That difficult. What would you say are some of his other roles that maybe are worth trying to reach out to see, just to continue to get a sense of what he was like as an actor?
That's a good question. I think what would be his third? I think, in a sense, there was this. I know this. A lot of people don't think so, but I think so. There was a picture. Anthony Mann was a wonderful director in the 60s and the 70s, and he made a lot of westerns, and most of them were with Jimmy Stewart. They were kind of partners, and actually Mann was the one who turned Stewart into, you know, the hard nose. But Stewart at a certain point and Mann had a falling out, and the decision was made to put Gary Cooper into this Western instead, and it still worked, and it's a very violent Western. It's called Man of the West. I think that, and Cobb is, you know, he's absolutely nuts in this picture. He plays a lunatic, and he's supposed to play a lunatic. I think that will give you one sense of his character. But the other picture, which I think ranks up there with On the Waterfront in 12 Angry Men, and some people say might be even better, not because he's better in it but than in the others, but simply because it's a bigger part, is The Brothers Karamazov. He really is the father. I mean, he comes right off the pages of Dostoevsky, and to a degree that none of the other characters do, frankly. The picture is not a very good picture, But Cobb is fabulous in it. And that was kind of the consensus too when it came out that he just left. I mean, you know, he had other actors like Yul Brynner and Maria Schell and Richard Basehart, and he just left them all in the dark. Because he's the only one, I think, who really had that rapacious sense of Karamazov's character. So those are the three. I would start with those three. And then, for fun, I would put in Man of the West.
Did you see his TV version of Death of a Salesman?
Yes, I did see it. I'll tell you the truth. I was, I'm not going to tell you how old I was, but I was very, very young. My uncle even took me to the original Broadway play. And I wish I could remember a lot of it. I don't. But maybe just some of it just kind of like, you know, like infiltrated my skin or something. My uncle always told me that, yes, I took you to see that. My uncle, this was a very strange story. My uncle was blind, but he was always getting tickets because he worked, he had a newsstand in Brooklyn. And people were always coming by, and because there was a courtroom upstairs, and there were always a whole lot of celebrities coming in to be tried on one federal court charge or another, the Danny Kays and the Ray Milans and all of these people, and they'd all end up at my uncle. And one way or another, he would end up with a lot of tickets, and we would go up to the lake all the time.
What are you working on now? Or do you want to talk at all any current projects?
Well, I'm down to the last. There are a couple of novels of mine, actually, that just came out. One is, there's a novella out, which is called All the Aliens in the Neighborhood. That's online. People can get that online. Also, a double book. I've written also a series of police procedurals. And the double book, the first double book came out. It's called, the idea is they wanted to put two in one as a kind of enticement for the subsequent books that will be coming out over the next 4 years. But one is called The Bolivian Sailor, and the other one is called The Fantasy League Murder. So those two are out. They're both online and in paperback. And I am, I think, within a week, I'll have finished a book on James Stewart Blackton, whom I'm sure nobody out there has heard of. But James Stewart Blackton was probably as responsible for the American film industry as Thomas Edison and D.W. Griffith was. And so this is a story of, basically, of the origins of American film.
No, that's good because it gets you back into the history part of it again. And as I say, that's what comes through this book so well is the historical background that you bring to the discussion of Cobb. Are there any other actors at this point? Or have you pretty? You said you had the four, and that.
I can't see myself doing that. Aside from everything else, Joel, I'm running out of life here.
Well, that's,
you know?
Yeah, well. How about more baseball, though?
No, absolutely no baseball. I've got to take that back. A couple of, about 10 years ago, a friend and I wrote a biography of Hal Chase, the baddest of the bad guys. And we just heard from Nebraska Press that they want to, that they bought the rights to it and they want to reissue it as a new book, which is fine. So if you ever see something called The Black Prince, that's about Hal Chase. It's a wonderful character again. Some of these things you get praised for, just like actors all the time get praised for, you know, being great in this part. Writers sometimes get praised for the books they've written. But I'll tell you the truth, it's just as in movies, it happens to be the writing, you know, which allows the actors to be good. And just as in books, it happens to be the subjects, which make the writers look good. So, you know, I mean, like, you should always kind of, like, back up when you kind of start feeling like, oh, you've accomplished something, you know, like unprecedented. No, you haven't. You wouldn't have gotten any kind of recognition at all without the kind of subject that you're dealing with.
Well, That's true, but you also did a lot of research on this and talked to a lot of people, so there's no question that that helped. But I will agree with you. It wouldn't make much sense to write a book about Lee J. Cobb if there was no Lee J. Cobb. So
Exactly. And probably, you know, a lot of people would say, my God, look at all these empty pages here.
Well, thank you for talking to me about this book. And as I said before, I hope people read it and look behind just the surface part of a great career, but also all of the interesting aspects of Hollywood history and film history and social history that comes through with it, with other parts of it. It definitely gave the book an extra layer that is certainly makes it even better.
Well, I appreciate your saying that, man.
Thank you for talking to me today, and especially about such an underappreciated actor.
Take care, man. Thanks. You very much.
I hope you enjoyed Don's discussion of Lee J. Cobb, who deserves to be celebrated for his life and career. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.